listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between you, your well-being, the well-being of your family, community, region, society, and the well-being of planet Earth, because we live in an interconnected world, even though we each live our individual lives. And it's something that we are in the process of kind of coming to understand more and more as individuals, groups, and a society. And, of course, we've recently reported on Climate Week, and we've reported on the environment for many, many years, over a decade, actually. So the reasons for that are all too apparent. I'm a longstanding journalist in these areas of environment, health, food, agriculture, media, and as well as popular attitudes and understandings, you know, what we know, what we believe, and how we act accordingly. We cover, we have a lot of activists, authors, poets, filmmakers, organizers, scientists, doctors, you know, on this show. And today's show is a bit unique and different, because today we're going to be featuring Alan Clements, who I've always found as, you know, someone who's kind of skeptical of inner solutions for privileged people, and I'm pretty open about that. You know, I've found some interest in his work because I consider him a unique bridge between spirituality, activism, and our role as citizens in our society. He has a very interesting and complex history, which we'll be discussing a bit on the show. He's also the author of a new book. He's written many books, Wisdom for the World. And for New Yorkers, he's going to be presenting here in New York this coming Friday, just a couple of days from now. So we'll be talking all about that in this program. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Alan Clements.
Good morning, Allison. Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you here.
Lovely.
You know, one of the things that that you talk about, which is probably the term from Buddhism that for that's always carried a lot of interest and kind of weight for me as an activist, is Dharma. And mm-hmm. I kind of feel that it's kind of central to the bridge that we're discussing, and I wonder mm-hmm. if you could define it for our listeners.
Okay. Yes, absolutely, Allison. It's a thoroughly abused word, and it's a complex word. If you look at the Sanskrit dictionary, which is a Sanskrit word, Dharma, there's 100 pages of definition. And the Buddhist Pali word, the tradition I come from, it's spelled slightly different, Dhamma, Dhamma. I use the word Dharma because it's more well-known. In short, what it means is lawfulness and architecture, patterns, conditionality, laws that can be understood as a framework for consciousness in context to self, to planet, to cosmos. So it's the physics of consciousness as it is understanding our intimate interrelatedness with things. So in other words, it's the study of states of consciousness. For example, if we're angry, we have a sense of justified upset. We feel a quality of contraction. We objectify the problem often to be external. That set of comments I just made could be seen as dharmas or lawful characteristics and manifestations of the state of mind called anger. On a very simple level, it could be understood as freedom. Freedom of mind, freedom from fear, freedom from greed, freedom from ignorance. Also, the opposite, which is a positive freedom, Allison, of the evolution of the true, the good, the beautiful, the evolution of generosity, of loving kindness, of compassion. It's also, to conclude, a very complex definition. It's really the practice of global human rights. It's the practice of freedom of speech. It's the exercise of freedom of conscience. It's the practice of freedom of thought. And it's the abstention, the renunciation of things that contradict or denigrate inner environmentalism and external sanity to the planet. So those are some of the basic definitions. And if you want to remember the most important, what you think and feel and say, how does it affect your interior environment? And it's the study of its effect externally, contextually. Dharma.
Thank you. That is really beautiful. And there is a lot in that to reflect on and unpack. Because in effect, you know, the way that spirituality is often taught, there's a kind of premise within it that you have completely stepped beyond. And that premise is, if I do something, you know, if I meditate, for example, and work on my inner environment, then this is going to inevitably radiate out and change the whole world without reference to what may be going on in the world, which I may be evading or, you know, feel very uncomfortable about. I mean, who doesn't feel uncomfortable about what's going on in the world today?
Exactly.
You know, we're in a very a moment of tremendous risk and turmoil. But what you're actually saying is that there's a larger context for spiritual alignment that is both inner and outer, and that we can actually look in both directions, you know, as a kind of continuity to align with and strengthen, you know, what is in alignment for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have a little post that I just want to read because I think it's quite relevant, and it's also something that we need in a time where, especially now with, you know, last week we were talking about the environment and mm-hmm. Greta Thunberg, and, there, you know, for the last 2 weeks, really, there have been global events on climate. Now we're in the public life, we're in the throes of political acts of wrongdoing of various kinds, and also, you know, the repercussions of how those are addressed. So I think it's actually quite a dramatic and confusing moment in which we happen to be speaking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I actually, you know, sorting all of that out with, you know, people having various opinions about it, which is the world that I personally occupy a lot of, I think probably many people are in a state of somewhat confusion about the current transitions that are coming up in American life, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So you offer a meditation or a reflection on world dharma, and it kind of derives from the question, "What makes you stronger?" You say, "Mindful intelligence makes you stronger." And then you ask, what does that mean? And you say, giving a shit whether you walk your talk and having at least one awesome friend that calls you on your stuff. You also have it in you to stop and change on the spot makes you stronger. Acting in dignity makes you stronger. Self-acceptance, flaws and all make you stronger. Living at the front lines of a true and authentic life make you stronger. Caring for others and giving a shit about truth and integrity in your relationships make you stronger. Ceasing collusion makes you stronger. Fighting for justice and standing tall in conscience, regardless of profit and social acceptance, makes you stronger. And, you know, that last statement is really powerful because, you know, one of the things that I think we kind of have to keep traversing, you know, we have a dawning of an increased social understanding, you know, societal understanding among a growing population of people that are social structures, and the corruption and collusion therein, and even the very organization, the economic organization of this society, have really taken us to the brink of survival, and if remaining in control could, you know, have driven many and are continuing and will drive our species, into over the edge. But one of the things about that that I think we don't grasp so clearly is there are some people who have suffered the ill effects, for example, of capitalism, of economic oppression, of social injustice, of inequity, more completely, and therefore they readily see what I've just described. They ask for change, and yet people who are more educated, more affluent, haven't really seen our own role in colluding with this, and you know, so therefore, I mean, the president, of whom I am not a fan at all and never have been, and have really, he's terrible. I mean, there's nothing to be said. But he's not one man that's outside ourselves and that, you know, everything was perfect before. If he goes away, it'll all be fine again. We have colluded to create this whole situation. And the part where we take responsibility for our collusion and change it, I feel could be really turnkey in moving in the right direction. I'd love your thoughts on that.
Well, beautifully expressed. Such an incredibly complex context that we're, you know, embedded in by birth, by function of birth. We're compelled to eat, to sleep, to procreate, to answer the call of nature, to live within this anatomical photonic structure of light and body and blood. I mean, there's so many forces that compel us to live a conditioned life. And within that, there seems to be, you know, to quote Viktor Frankl in Mankind's Search for Meaning, there were those few among us in the camps at Auschwitz that walked among the people and gave away their last morsel of food. There is that sense of choice. And if I were to isolate upon a state of consciousness, Allison, that I most empower, is that I have a choice in what I think, say, and do. And that, to me, is the basis of decency, of dignity, of global human rights, of environmental sanity. Examine your behavior, Alan. That was what was drilled into us in the monastery. Examine your state of mind. How does it affect you? And be honest of how it affects and impacts others. And so this is what we called mindful intelligence in the monastery, very different than mindfulness in mainstream, which is being co-opted by the military to fly drones more effectively, to reduce the stress in Google and Facebook, and quite frankly, meditation and mindfulness and intelligence, it should be a disruptor to increase the stress of collusion with killing. And so this issue of how to be live in some form of dignity, wisdom, and compassion for a life larger than your own self-interest. That's the conundrum that we're living in that's called the religious, the spiritual, the philosophical life. Now, just to make this very tangible, I was recently in the country of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, a country I'd spent in and out of for 40 years. But, you know, I toured the country, Allison, just to feel what democracy in convulsive expression looks like after 5 decades of, you know, terrorizing dictatorship and toxic masculinity and patriarchy and 160 years of British domination and enslavement. And it's not pretty. And I went out to this area, 300,000 people, the most impoverished area of Burma, called Slankaya. And I walked around with some people from the Ministry of Education who gave me a tour to really feel the people. And, you know, you can't even imagine how poor these people are. The kids, 100 strong, don't even know their names, don't know when they were born, have never been to school, can't spell, can't read, don't even know their parents, a lot of them. and they're being taken care of by kids 2 to 3 to 4 years older when the parents, when they are able to work, Allison, go into town, hour or two by bus each way, to make $1 or 2 a day. And what are they doing, I ask? Well, they're making garments for us. They're building cars for us. They're building 5-star hotels for us. They're building 5-star condominiums for us. All about us called democracy and freedom. And I looked this concept up, and apparently William Canton described this thing as ghost slaves. We're talking about collusion here with our luxury, with our wealth, on the precipice, which, you know, Greta is talking about, the girl from Sweden. The house is on fire. We're all facing possibility of extinction, maybe even near-term extinction. And yet business as usual in this house that's on fire. And so the examination of collusion, I found that there was at least 80 slaves to keep my life in luxury. For my clothes, my iPhone, the technology that we use, the cars that we drive, everyone is in this, you know, economic homicidal economy with our foot pedal on denial. And I'm not judging anyone. You know, it's just the most intractable, complicated circumstances. And so the person of conscience today, I would think, a little bit like the Vietnamese monk way back when, in 65, when he lit himself on fire, to bring the world's attention, if you will, to the crisis of life in Vietnam based upon the invasion of his people by the American ideology of killing nearly 2 million people in the name of a lie. And so I asked people and asked myself endlessly, Allison, how am I lying? How am I in denial? What are the factors of deception and shame and self-deception that block me from understanding how I'm impacting family, community, city, nation, globe in the future of life with my blindness to ideology and my addiction to denial? And I don't offer a solution, except I have found that, you know, mindfulness is in the military. I'll close with this. You know, you're looking through a scope, and you see someone over there very much like, you know, anyone that's been killed through a sniper. And you are mindfully aiming at this object called enemy, enemy of America. Yet there's a moment of conscience, and you wonder, okay, I don't need to be mindful of killing effectively to reduce my stress. I need to be mindful of why I'm even shooting this individual. Why do I thinking this person's an enemy? And so we need to put down the gun of ignorance and greed and ask ourselves, how am I in collusion with the perpetuation of denigration? How am I colluding with extinction? How am I colluding with the apparatus of the Trump machine? How am I colluding with the apparatus of social denigration? Where am I embedded in capitalism for my needs? And that's a very complicated question, a very complicated answer. But I think at least we go to bed at night with the, you know, the inevitable, most beautiful human right, dignity, human dignity. I've interviewed hundreds of political prisoners, and when I ask them, how do you get through the most dark times in incarceration, being imprisoned for your views, they say, we learned how to live in dignity. The way that we ate, we did in dignity. The way that we sat in the prison cell, stuffed in like clams, we sat in dignity. Now, mind you, not all of them do. But that quality of non-collusion with denigration, I think, is the core of a perennial wisdom, a religion beyond religion, and a spirituality that exceeds spirituality. Ask ourselves the question, like Elie Wiesel said, who am I? What am I doing? What is the impact of my thoughts, my speech, and my action on self, culture, globe, and the future of life?
Very, very beautiful and orienting, I think, for people now. And, you know, in asking the question, I'm just going to probe a little bit more here. I think we're, you know, your view is very clear, but just to kind of make some part of it a little more explicit, that kind of self-honesty and self-inquiry and prompting for change, can open the pathway for a different kind of living, a different kind of social participation and engagement, and a loosening and reorientation of the social ties and consensus that keep us kind of being bound to our group, or going along with, if our group is going along with something, you know, we're being kindly or nice if we don't affront those individuals. And we, you know, may be inwardly opposed, but outwardly silent and participating. So, you know, it takes one to, you know, your teaching, it would seem, would take people to the point where they would be, you know, the next step in that process would be making a different social choice, even if it was not popular or condoned, you know, by those among whom one lives and has relied. Because, you know, this has always been also for me like part of the, I mean, the Buddhist perspective includes the concept of Sangha, which is, you know, the group of other devotees who are meditating together. But actually, you know, we don't have economic dealings within the Sangha very often,
right.
You know, for funding right. the Sangha. We don't earn our living in the Sangha. We don't partake, you know, of meeting our needs for housing and everything within the Sangha. So there's a whole level of what, you know, our role, interaction, place, and involvement in community that can then, you know, tie us back into these collusions. And it's at that point, you know, inwardly one may safely feel these other things, but then, you know, outwardly one could be the mindful person, you know, who's the sniper, as you point out. And you know, and of course, most people listening to this are not in that particular role, but if we are silent on military engagement, then we are actively in collusion with those who are putting that in motion and enacting that on both personally and, you know, on other people's and as a matter of national policy. I mean, one of the things that was shocking to me that I kind of keep going back to is in attending the recent town hall on climate that was given on CNN in the absence of the debates really addressing that topic thoroughly, you know, a number of the candidates, while, you know, professing and claiming and promising and doing all they do to, you know, imply that they will take the kind of action that Greta Thunberg, you know, and Bill McKibben and many other people have been calling for, you know, on the other hand, they're standing up and saying, I believe that we're the leader of the world, you know, as Americans, and you know, and sort of basically enlisting us in our dominion in military action and being the policemen of the world. And the thing is that most people actually don't even hear that this is going on, nor is there even though, you know, we've had a million articles that point out that military action, you know, is one of the largest contributors to climate change. It's never mentioned.
Exactly.
And then economically, it also ties up our resources and invests them in precisely the wrong direction. And yet every time, you know, a candidate, and they did it one after another, stands with, you know, one exception, stands up and says, you know, we Americans, it appeals to this sense of pride, and that very... And loyalty, and that very pride and loyalty is corrupt right there, and people don't even feel they can oppose it or even notice it. It's been normalized to the point of it's deadened. People don't see it. It's said publicly, but it's invisible.
Mm-hmm. Complicated comments, complicated issues. You know, I go back to my own roots, Allison, in the study of revolution. intense societal political change, like my study of dictatorship both in Yugoslavia at times, and the study of genocide and ethnic cleansing also in Burma. My first book back in 89 was called Burma, the Next Killing Fields. I take the position, it's very simple, I don't want to sound simplistic about it, but it's super complex, it's very straightforward, so that people have a practical, I should say not people, this is how I live, take it off other, is I'm not a big person, I'm not being invited on to the, you know, international television shows, I'm not debating Trump, I'm not a presidential candidate, you know, my books aren't bestsellers on, you know, the international New York Times. I do believe that I'm interacting with life every minute of my day. And I take pride and wisdom and hope and moral courage and mindful intelligence from the people I've met, especially former political prisoners, who I find remarkable, who are willing to speak their mind and exercise their thought and conscience regardless of the consequences. There are epic individuals in almost every culture. But they have informed me that, Alan, the way of successful revolution is one person at a time. That we didn't do it to overthrow the dictator. We didn't do it to transform the fabric of totalitarianism brought to us by the British. You know, we did it because it was an act of conscience that was within our means. We did it at home first, Alan. And I really love that, Allison, that call it mindful intelligence in interaction. That I cannot be who I am, the South African term, Ubuntu, without other. And who I am is a measure of my worth based upon how I feel you. So that mindfulness and meditation and intelligence, empathy, are all informed by how well do I care for the person in front of me, my wife, my husband, my child, my inner Buddha, my pets, for God's sake, my clothing, my food, my posture. And so people talk about doing yoga and they talk about sitting meditation. I say abandon those practices and make it a way of living, just like we breathe. We don't practice breathing in a yoga studio. Yes, you do something there as well, but you can't breathe today to hold breath in for tomorrow. You don't go back to the studio to be who you want to be right now. So this living, breathing, mindful, intelligent Ubuntu, I think it really comes back to you and I, how well do we interact in a way that's conscious, conscientious, caring, and embodies our values and principles, and let that, if it does, let that rippling effect of transformational wisdom be seen by the stranger next to us in the subway, or by my friend who asks you, how was your day today? And I say, well, Allison and I talked, what did you talk about? We talked about what it meant to care for one another in our immediate circle. I think if people did that more and more and saw that they have every ability to manifest the highest values of non-collusion with the denigration of life right here and right now, then that becomes a very doable revolution. And I would say it's the revolution of one person at a time.
But what if, for example, I'm going to push back on you here, because
you can,
we've heard
absolutely.
This
I love it.
One at a time thing, you know, and then people retreat off into a corner. So, you know, what if that involves, for example, work that serves the people with great economic wealth and who are putting forth these destructive agendas? What if, as many people are, people are conscripted to work on behalf of these destructive, larger systemic forces. Because, what you know, the picture of one at a time, I mean, there's obviously that is very important. You know, I don't want to minimize that. At the same time, if one is entangled with these destructive forces, and therefore promoting them, serving them and advancing them. And I, you know, I'm thinking of very specific instances of this, of which I personally am aware. How does that work? Because, you know, one could be the nicest, kindest neighbor, friend, partner, and still be, in effect, devoting one's work to the service toward these destructive forces.
Well, thank you for asking the question. There's no pushback at all. I'm just being cautious with how radical I want to be, truly. And so thank you for the invitation. I say if you notice any collusion where you're participating in the destruction and the denigration that impacts life in such a negative way, cease that activity, as I said when you read my little piece, cease on the spot. And do the very biblical thing that we all are, you know, have, at least I was trained to do, put yourself in the mind and body of the other. How would you like to be spoken to or behaved with? And if you feel that it would be unpleasant to feel what you're doing, then cease that behavior. Morally rise up and stop. But, you know, this is where mindfulness, you were earlier saying in the preface, this is where I'm really at odds with Western spirituality, most of it, and the mass lay mindfulness movement that's been co-opted to reduce stress so that you can participate in corporate denigration and violent behaviors. I say increase your conscious stress, and if you feel it, and if you cannot be heard within the context that things need to change, then have the moral courage and do all that you possibly can to pare down your life, to live within your means, and to cease compromising your conscience and give up those particular denigrating behaviors and actions. Quit your damn job. I think if enough people did that, then things would change. You know, I have stopped participating in global Buddhism. I've stopped my paying rent. I've stopped driving cars as much as humanly possible. I'm living in a suitcase for a year and a half. I'm doing all that I can to stop and to understand more of the power of the one and resilience. And I really encourage people, you know, stress is often the best news imaginable, that what you're doing is dead end. And if anxiety couples it and all of a sudden you're choosing or feeling that you're depressed, don't go to a psychiatrist to drug it down. See it as actually a benediction, a heavenly messenger, that what you have is the awakening of conscience, that what you're doing, what you're behaving, how you're going about it, you've got a moral compass inside that says maybe this is not the right way. And ask a good friend, find a mentor, and decide if it is or it isn't. And if it is, quit. There are lots of things that you can do in the world other than collude with the denigration of life and the murder of the future.
So let's say I'm just making up a really concrete and rather primitive example here. Let's say I'm a designer, and I have a good income. I make high-end clothing that is only affordable by wealthy people. The fabrics, you know, are shipped around the world to get the rarest ones that are used, you know, and this is an act of beauty. It's an act of aesthetic creation. there are people, you know, willing to pay for this, and I have a very wealthy clientele in the company that I'm working for. You know, people buy. So is that, and yet, and this is
quit.
In the service of the people.
Just quit.
Yeah, just quit something.
Just quit. Quit with a loud voice of how wrong it is. And do all that you can to infiltrate as many people with the truth of the circumstance that what we're doing is decidedly wrong. Why? Because it doesn't serve you. It's the denigration of life. Look at companies like Lululemon that, you know, that mass manufacture microplastics. I mean, everyone who wears them primarily, you know, swears by organic, does yoga, but by and large perpetuates the myth that they're, you know, supporting the future of life, when in fact you're perpetuating the murder of life. So just look into the implications of your behavior, like planting trees. Why don't we talk about not clear cutting? You know, it's like talking about let's produce more fish rather than stopping killing animals. I mean, so there's ways to really look at things that exceed your logic, and when in doubt, ask someone as a mentor, read a book, ask a discussion, or, you know, bring into your corporate elite clothing garment world a discussion on the ethical wisdom of what we do. And is it true that what we do supports life, or does it denigrate life? And how can we improve those circumstances? The time is really run out. I mean, it's possible, Allison. I think the unspoken elephant on the globe today is, have we crossed the tipping point in the climate emergency? Is it really, are we really already past the point of no return? And if that's possible, if that's likely, the whole game is different than what we're talking about. So there's a big question. I'm a participant in the very thing that you just brought up. How is my lifestyle perpetuating, you know, not just the death of the species, but the death of life as we know it? And I think that's a very important question for all of us. I beg our politicians. I beg our leaders. I beg everyone in the world, with Greta coming the way she is to our shores, we have a moment to pause and interrupt the apparatus of greed, ignorance, and fear, and ask the deepest, most hard questions imaginable. Do we have a future? And what am I doing to perpetuate the myth of that future? Or am I actually doing things to support a true future to believe in? Is it life or is it death? We have to ask that question right now, because it's on our watch, as you know so well. It's on our watch whether there will be a future or perhaps no future at all as we know it. It's a very, very important, epic, in fact, perhaps the most important existential issue we've ever faced on planet Earth.
Well, you know, it's interesting because every time the climate crisis, and actually I wrote a book called Health at the Tipping Point, which I couldn't get published 10 years ago by commercial publishers.
Wow. There you go. What an example.
So, yeah, so this is exactly this precise topic. And, of course, my orientation was and has remained, you know, to prevent that eventuality. But, you know, we haven't been really... you know, we haven't really been able to do that. And, you know, so, but whenever we talk about the crisis and when it's talked about on television or whatever, you know, people will call it an existential crisis. And, you know, I always feel in that usage that the word existential actually puts people to sleep by distancing them from the word crisis. If, you know, this is a long Latinate word, you know, before we get to crisis, it's kind of almost blocking the way to the reality of crisis. And but what your use of the existential, which is, you know, about our existence and how we, you know, we really are coping at this complex moment, you know, as it keeps building forward, I think that is, like, what we should be thinking about in terms of, you know, what role am I playing? I mean, I, you know, like, you know, what if I'm a waiter in a restaurant that is, it's not a chain, it's a high-end restaurant, and it's frequented by very high net worth individuals who are profiting, you know, from the industries that are Earth destructive. You know, I think the dilemma of people often is that they are the waiter, or they're the you know, the maitre d' who, you know, is like kind of has a better role in a status sense and earns more money. You know, we're at different places in this social spectrum where we are serving this. You know, without, and kind of, you know, in the name of survival. So it's not about like a harsh or shaming judgment, but it's about, you know, the implications of waking up from that. And also, I think another part of it is one of the things that looking at your history is the fear of being an outcast. You know, when we see the way outcasts or people of lower economic means are treated, people greatly and rightly fear stepping away from the ties that bind them into these kinds of different forms of participation that we've been talking about. It's kind of like the rules of the social consensus prohibit it, and the punishment that we see meted out toward people who take that a different kind of stand, you know, is very fear provoking. But you're somebody who has been a social outcast and has made those choices. I mean, what are the lessons of that for that you would offer to our listeners?
Oh wow, what a authenticity and integrity and conscience has a price. It means you will be vilified, denigrated. You will be an outcast. You'll have a smaller circle of intimates. You'll pay the price economically. Your income will go drastically down. Opportunities will cease to be available. Good people like you will see the light and support as a fellow outcast to bring voice to the darkness. And, you know, I'm a small person, but I have admired radical individuals who've brought light, safety, peace, sanctity, and the future of life to life. I don't know what that is about. I don't know why. But I refused to participate in the war machine in college. I quit the University of Virginia, where I could have been a lawyer, had a six-year scholarship. I could have been somebody. And I chose, you know, I chose to walk on, to use, you know, the U2 song. I walked on. And there's something in the middle of the day, in the end of the day, Allison, in the beginning of the day, in the morning, where it's not easy to be alone, to be denigrated, to be lied about, to be, you know, spoken about in ways that are dishonest and untrue. But you learn not to develop a thick skin, but you draw nearer. This is my point. You draw nearer to those few people that are bright stars, your tribe, in your life, and you draw strength from that constellation of goodness. And the reward of living within conscience is so remarkable, so beautiful. I mean, I was so blessed as I traveled the world to meet these radical voices. I've got four books coming out February 20th, 2020, called Burma's Voices of Freedom. It's a seven-year investigation of the top, not always the most, you know, popular, but 100 of the most radical revolutionaries who empowered nonviolence to challenge dictatorship, and what their lives were like, and how did they find strength to do it. And it was just that tipping point inside where they went from collusion with fear, and where they began to, as Aung San Suu Kyi, I did the book with her back in 96 called The Voice of Hope, they use a phrase, they didn't overcome fear, they learned how to coexist with fear. So the phrase, learning how to quiver with fear, became an act of conscience. And it's a turning point. It's a turning point from collusion, where all of a sudden you don't need to be fearless. You just need to learn how to coexist with incredible, the awakening of conscience, which is quivering with fear, because you all of a sudden have gained your integrity. I mean, you could imagine all of a sudden if President Trump were listening to us, and for who knows what reason, he did a high dose of metaphorical LSD, or he just had an act of God, or he went down on his knees, or, you know, who knows why. And it was like, oh, my God, I have seen the light. Well, I'm a real believer that, you know, a lot of really crass, ignorant, dumb people like myself when I was younger, I had an awakening. And if I can do it, you can do it. And so part of the deal is go back to your family, go back to your inner tribe and people, and be your most authentic self. You know, don't be, you know, try to be a global mystical activist, but, you know, if you're working in a job that's difficult, or if you have a stressful life, apply your principles of religion, philosophy, and spirituality right at home. right at home. Be the best person that you can be. What does it mean to ask questions, to go beyond the collusion with silence? You know, I've had a recent death in my family, and part of the reason for that death was an unfortunate circumstance that no one really asked the questions that could have been asked prior to that death. And I really beg people to really empower spirituality and meditation as an act of questioning, intimate questioning. Who are you, wife? Who are you, husband? How do you feel today? And that gives you strength to build this moral courage to possibly be the next Rosa Parks. Who knows?
Wow, that really takes it home in a different way than follow the train of thoughts in your mind so that you can, you know, go out and solicit donors for your project or whatever.
Yeah, no, I'm a two with that thought. Leave the money off the table and keep the heart of the matter close to the front of who you are. Keep it so simple, because remember, I'm coming from the school, not remember, but I'll just share with you. A lot of my teachers and mentors, Allison, have been prisoners of conscience. And I don't know why I've been gravitating towards them for the last 35 years, but it's an undeniable dignity to go to prison and to suffer the greatest indignities. How many women I've met who've been gang-raped in prison, many of them broken, but those who weren't broken, and those who were broken had other women who supported them, that they didn't regret their decisions. They stood up for the future of life. And there's something quite beautiful about that. We have a young Swedish activist coming to our soil today to meet with millions of other boys and girls around the world on Boycott Fridays from school, and not to mention the adults who understand, who are asking, do you care about the future of life? Do you care about the data? Do you care about what you do that's either perpetuating safety and peace, or do you care about stopping what you do that perpetuates denigration and possibly global annihilation? And so we're asking ourselves today to go beyond our religion, philosophies, our gender, our nationality, and to empower a world dharma, a global environmental sanity, a global human rights, a democracy that exceeds culture, and ask ourselves the most difficult questions of all. How does my thoughts, speech, and action impact my family, my community, my country, and my globe? And write them down. And if you have the courage to intercept and stop those denigrating behaviors, then write two or three things down that you can do to intercept and stop those behaviors slowly. And let me say this, you know, people often ask me, because of my history as a Buddhist monk and having spent a considerable amount of time in silence and meditation, what is meditation? And if I may add, since you even haven't asked the question, because I think meditation is a very misunderstood word in the West, in the world, it comes from the Sanskrit Buddhist Pali word bhavana, B-H-A-V-N-A, and it means the beautification of the mind. And going deeper into that, it's knowing, it's having the wisdom and the mindful intelligence to choose beautiful states of consciousness. And so meditation, in the training that I got in Burma at the epicenter of the mindfulness movement, was, Alan, do you know the colors on the palette of your own inner mind? The colors of beauty, what would they be? Authenticity. Do you know how to put your mind into the emotion of authenticity? Integrity. Do you know how to put your mindfulness into the emotion of integrity? Conscience. Do you even know what conscience is, Alan? You ever felt it? Do you know how to apply mindful intelligence to submerge yourself in conscience and have the courage, Alan, to feel the voice of conscience? They would speak to you that way. So you're developing inner artistry, they would say. So meditation is bhavana, or the beautification of consciousness, or the action of inner artistry as it applies to the canvas of context. And so when you think about, do I want to beautify my mind today in relationship to other, or do you want to watch your breath in 5 minutes at the end of the week to reduce stress? You choose. And so many people have been co-opted by the commerciality of reducing stress. Just practice 5 minutes every other day. Well, that's just nonsense. Give up that story and say, listen, I'm a human being. I'm breathing all the time. Why can't I be the best that I can be wherever I am, just like I breathe? And what is meditation? Breathing beautiful states of mind. You have a choice, coming back to Viktor Frankl's state. There were those few among us in Auschwitz that gave away their last morsel of food. Be that person, Alan. That's how I was spoken to in the monastery. Be that person who gives something, not just thinks about giving. Be that person who puts yourself in the mind and body of another person. Be empathy. Don't just talk about being empathetic. So they would apply to this process that meditation is an action, not just sitting still, watching your breath.
Thank you. That's really fantastic. I love that. It's an action.
Great.
That's the shift right there. I'm sorry to have to ask this question, but I can't keep away from it. And before we get into it, I just want to say for New Yorkers who might be listening that Alan Clements will be in a conversation in New York City this Friday. There'll be a World Dharma Forum as part of the Global Crisis and Inner Acts of Rebellion. This Friday, from 6:30 to 9 p.m., Alan will be in conversation at the Padma Meditation Center at 6 West 14th Street, number 2B, New York, New York. You can go to his Facebook page or his website, alanclements.com, in order to, sign up, because there are a limited number of spaces. His book, again, is World of Wisdom, and actually Alan's written many, many books with more forthcoming, and you can find out more about those at his website, alanclements.com. Now for the zingery final question.
Openly, Alison, openly, freely, let's practice what we're talking
well,
about.
Well, you're talking about political prisoners, so I just have to ask about Julian Assange.
Yes, Nobel Peace Prize. He should win the Nobel Peace Prize. He should, I think.
Well, I agree with you. And, he's I've been in the media for decades, and, he is basically filling in for the shortfalls in our media and paying a very, very steep price. So I think whatever people's political persuasions, what you said about people of conscience who do what they must do and who pay the price, I mean, to me, he's a very salient exemplar of that for our culture. So,
yes, he has embodied an enormously high degree of ethical courage, I think, and mindful intelligence. Set aside the issues through the media of his humanness. What he has provided as a mirror of our government, the global corporate elite, the lies, the deception, the murders, and the behaviors to denigrate him and to vilify him is such a clear example of the forces of darkness and evil trying to blot out decency, conscience, and quite frankly, the very future of life. And so, yes, it's a great example. We also have enormous examples. We have, our great underground conductress, Harriet Tubman, for God's sake. Now, here she is enslaved and beaten and escapes to Canada and freedom, and she has an act of conscience, as everyone knows, and said, my freedom is not complete without helping to support the freedom of others, and comes back and risks her life. And how often I've heard the quote, often prior to her passing away, if she had any regrets, she said, yes, I wish I could have convinced 1,000 more of my black brothers and sisters. They were actually slaves, but they were so conditioned and indoctrinated in the white apparatus of slavery, they didn't know it. And so we're in this embeddedness, and sometimes we don't understand our slavery. But Julian and many other people throughout history, and perhaps people this month, will rise up in their courage and take these great examples and break the spell of greed-driven servitude and go, you know, salvation, hallelujah, and pray our acts collectively, you know, protect the future of life. What is there to life without life? And so let us participate as a life-giving expression of being and really examine our collusion to the denigration of life.
Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots, Alan Clements. It's been a real honor and blessing to hear your thoughts and be in dialogue with you. Thank you so much.
Allison, and, my honor. Thank you so much. And thank the listeners for listening.
Yeah, thank you, listeners. If you're in New York, check out the event this Friday, October 4th. You know, maybe see you there. And thank you, listeners. Each week on Connect the Dots, we're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. So come back next week for our next edition. If you've enjoyed this show, it will be mounted in the Connect the Dots archive and under connectthedots.podbean.com, and you can find this show there and share it with friends on social media. I think it has Alan's work has a tremendous amount to offer us in this moment. Thank you for being with us, and until next time, I'm Allison Rose Levy. Heads up, keep marching forward in company with all our relations.